67. War Driving. Milgram sat beside Brown on one of the two benches in a very small park, under the bare branches of a row of young maples. In front of him was 50 feet of close-cropped grass, a 6-foot green-painted chain-link fence, a short steep decline covered with brambles, a wide gravel roadbed stained rust-red by its 4 lines of track, a paved road, and a vast stack of those metal boxes he'd seen on the ship in the harbor. He watched a streamlined metallic blue trailer truck drive quickly past, along the road, pulling a long rust-streaked gray box that evidently had wheels attached. Beyond the box pile were mountains. Beyond those, cloud. They made Milgram uneasy, these mountains. They didn't look as though they could be real. Too big, too close. Snow-capped. Like the logo at the start of a film. He looked to his right, focusing instead on a vast, almost featureless rectangular berg of concrete, windowless, probably 5 stories tall. On its front, in huge, simple sans-serif letters, reversed into the concrete between massive molded columns, he read, BC Ice and Cold Storage Limited. Rage. He glanced at Brown's busily shifting laptop screen, where satellite images of this port area zoomed in and out, were replaced, were overlaid with yellow grids. They had been war driving, Brown called it, ever since requisitioning Skink's Glock. This meant driving around with Brown's armored laptop open on Milgram's lap, announcing wireless networks as they passed through them. The laptop did this in a flat, breathless, peculiarly asexual voice that Milgram found distinctly distasteful. Milgram had had no idea that people had these networks in their houses and apartments, the sheer number of them amazing, nor that they extended so far beyond the owner's actual property. Some people named them after themselves, others were simply called default or network, and some were named things like Dark Harvester and Doomsmith. Milgram's job was to watch a window on the screen that indicated whether or not a network was protected. If a network was unprotected and had a strong signal, Brown could park and use his computer to get on the Internet. When he did this, color satellite images of the port would appear. Brown could zoom in on these, allowing Milgram to see the tops of individual buildings, even the rectangles of individual boxes. Initially, Milgram had found this mildly interesting, but now, after 3 hours of it, he was ready for Brown to find what he was looking for and take him back to the Best Western. This bench had been an improvement on seating in the car, though, and Brown seemed to have a solid connection from an apartment, CindyNet, in the 3-story stucco complex behind them, its brown-painted steel balconies stacked with barbecues, plastic chairs, and bicycles. But now Milgram's butt ached. He stood and rubbed it. Brown was engrossed in whatever he was doing. Milgram walked forward across the rough short grass, expecting to be stopped. No order came. When he reached the green fencing, he looked through it, to his left, and found a rectangular orange diesel train engine, its blunt nose painted with crisp diagonals in black and white. It sat inert on the nearest set of tracks, beside a rectangular white sign, obviously intended to be read by trainmen, that said Heatley. On a yellow triangle a few feet before it, reduce speed. He read the names on individual boxes in their stacks. Hanjin, Costco, Tex, K-Line, Maersk Sealand. Beyond them, further inside the port, were tall buildings of unknown purpose and the arms of those same orange cranes he'd seen from the Black Zodiac. He looked back at Brown, hunched over his little screen, lost to the world. "I could run away," Milgram said softly to himself. Then he touched the green-painted steel horizontal that topped the fence, turned and walked back to the bench. He missed his overcoat,